only being able to say that. Another joke. It has nothing to do with my sessions. Three missionaries were captured in Africa by a tribe that takes its enemies, kills them, and skins them and makes canoes out of them. One was a Baptist, let's say. One was, what else?
Well, the Lutheran's the last one. Was it?
Roman Catholic, and then there was a Lutheran. Now, this tribe, though, was merciful to the extent that they allowed their prisoners to choose the manner by which they would die. So they went to the first one, the Baptist, and said, "How do you want to die?" And he said, "Well, I think I'd like to die by poisoning. I choose death by poison." So they gave him poison, he administered it, and when he was dead, they skinned him, and they made a canoe out of his skin. Went to the Roman Catholic next and said, "How would you like to die?" He said, "Well, I think I'd like to die by gun." So they gave him a gun, he shot himself, and they skinned him, made a canoe out of him. They came to the Lutheran and said, "Well, how would you like to die?" And he said, "I choose death by fork." I said, "Death by fork?" Oh, said, "Okay, sure." So they gave him a fork. "You're not going to make a canoe out of me." Well, I should introduce myself shortly. How many were at the session yesterday on Islam? So a few, and are about half, and some new ones. My name is Volker Greifenhagen. I teach religious studies at Luther College, which is a federated college of the University of Regina, in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And that's above Montana and North Dakota, if you need to sort of place that geographically. And what I teach Islamic studies plus some courses in Hebrew Bible and surveys of world religion. So I have an academic interest in the study of Islam, of course. But I'm also a pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. I worked in campus ministry for many years, taught at the seminary, and also do a fair amount of supply preaching. And so I'm involved in the church. So I have a pastoral interest in this subject as well. And some of this will sound a little bit rehashed for you who are yesterday, but this will take me a few minutes to bring everybody on board. Please excuse me. But I think it's important for Christians to know about Islam for three basic reasons. First of all, it's sheer numbers. In sheer numbers, Islam is the second largest world religion. There are over 1 billion Muslims in the world today. So about at least one out of every five people that you could meet conceivably in the world would be someone who professes to be a Muslim. And that's not only over there someplace, but it's also here at home in the United States, in Canada, in North America, where there's been a tremendous growth in terms of the number of adherents to Islam, largely through immigration, also through conversion. All right? So that very soon, Islam will be the second largest religious group in North America as well. It will have outpaced the adherents of Judaism. So there'll be Christianity and then Islam. So that means Muslims are neighbors. It's not strange for a mosque to be in your neighborhood, or for your next-door neighbor across the street to be a Muslim, or your work colleague to be a Muslim, or kids in school that your kids or that you yourself go to school with to be Muslim. So that's one good reason. Second reason is that Islam is very prominent in world affairs, right? You hear, usually negatively, but you hear a lot about Islam in the news. Islam has been associated with a lot of negative stereotypes, particularly stereotypes dealing with violence, terrorism and so on, or with negative stereotypes dealing with gender issues such as the treatment of women. And in many people's minds, fed by the images they get from the media, this is what Islam's equated with. And stereotypes are a little bit problematic because they tend to tar everyone of a certain group with the same brush and sort of disregard what the deeper meanings of people's religious orientation might be. So that's another important reason for Christians to learn a little bit about Islam. But probably the most important reason is that Muslims are our cousins. Okay. Just as both Christianity and Judaism claim Abraham as their forefather in the faith, so also Muslims do, and claim descent, spiritually at least, through the other son of Abraham, Ishmael, and so they're part of the family. Now, Christians and Muslims have had a long history of a relationship. It's been a stormy relationship. It hasn't been all that good. Sort of like some families are, you know. It's the people that you're closest to in your family that you treat the worst, right? And so because Christians and Muslims have been related so closely, they haven't had the greatest relationship. So there, give three kind of compelling reasons for Christians to know a little bit more about Islam. Now, I'd like to just give you a little bit of an indication of my approach today. It's an approach that's very sympathetic to Islam, okay? To seeing it in the best light possible. It's not an approach to deny that Muslims, like other human beings, are involved in violence. And so on. But it is to apply the golden rule, right? To do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So in other words, I would like to present Islam as Muslims ideally would want it to be seen as. Just as we, when we're presenting our Christian faith, would tend to want others to see Christianity primarily as what it is ideally meant to be, not only in terms of its failures and shortcomings. Okay? It's not to deny that there are failures and shortcomings and negative things, but the starting point is to see it in its best light possible. And I think we can take a hint from Jesus' interaction with the Samaritans. Jews and Samaritans back in those days were sort of like Christians and Muslims. They were closely related and they hated each other. Today, often Islam is the religion that Westerners love to hate, right? So it's the same kind of situation. So same roots, but divided by certain theological and other matters. Yet Jesus, the Jew, did not express hatred to Samaritans, did not see them as a threat, but interacted with them, even used them as examples of the best of behavior. All right, you all know the story of the Good Samaritan, for instance, or the one healed leper who returned to give thanks was a Samaritan. Okay, so we should note that for all their doubts concerning the soundness of Christian theology and their experience of colonialism from the West, Muslims, at least by the dictates of their holy book and their early history, have an appreciation of Christianity, actually, a very high appreciation of Christianity. It was the Christian king of Ethiopia who gave the early Muslims shelter when they were being persecuted. So that's a memory that's very deep in Muslim consciousness, that Christians provided refuge during time of persecution. And the Quran speaks favorably of Christians as being those closest in affection to Muslims. And why? Because this is the reason it's given. Because Christians are devoted to learning. Because Christians are not afraid to renounce the things of this world in favor of bigger transcendent issues. And most importantly, because Christians are not arrogant. Interesting. Right? So, I often find, wow, with that picture, can we be like that? it's kind of a call coming from a very unexpected quarter for how we should be. So I guess God grant us the inspiration and the strength to actually be what this portrait paints us as. So today I'm going to introduce to you the basic beliefs of Islam. And we'll look at a variety of things. I'll do a little bit of presentation, and then I'll certainly hope that we have some time to talk about it. And while you're hearing some of these basic beliefs, you might be reflecting how they compare to what you know. I'm assuming most people in this room, if not all of you, are Christians to certain degrees, connected with some faith community. And how does this compare with your experience and your beliefs? And how do Christianity and Islam compare in terms of their beliefs? So we'll begin by looking at, and I'm going to use overheads. I'm sort of a teaching style right now, if you don't mind. We will talk too, but I'm sort of used to doing this in front of a room of about 80 students at 8:30 in the morning. And I assume you're a little bit more awake. So we're going to look at this. Can people see it? More or less. You can try. I just don't want people to go to sleep. You might want to keep the ones back there on. How's that? Is that good?
So is this back row guy.
Well, I know. It's my own personal experience. I always fall asleep in dark rooms. Okay, let's just look at the word Islam itself. This is a little lesson in linguistics, in Semitic languages. It's a lot of the terminology here is Arabic, of course. And Arabic is a language related to other Semitic languages like Hebrew in particular, and Ethiopic, and Syriac, and so on. And one of the features of these languages is that most words are built on a triconsonantal root. In other words, three consonants make up a word. Then you add different vowels before, after, in between to make different words that are all related somehow. Okay? So if you look at the word Islam, you would, if you sort of knew that, you would see the consonants S, L, and M. And you would know that those are the three important consonants. Somehow there's a root there. Now, if you look at those, S, L, and M, there's a word that's been adopted into the English language that also uses those letters that's become known as a greeting. Anybody sort of a riddle? Shalom. Shalom, right? Okay, so people know that word, okay? And it's related to the same greeting in Arabic, salam. Okay, so you have this root, shalom. Now, the S and the SH transfer back and forth between Semitic languages. There are complicated rules for why that happens. I don't even know them. But the same word appears in Hebrew, shalom, and also appears in Arabic, salam, meaning the same thing. Now, does anybody know what the word shalom means?
Farewell,
we'll see. It's used as a greeting. It's also used sometimes as a greeting when you start in driving, but it's often used when you're leaving. God be with you.
Peace.
Wholeness.
Peace,
yeah. Its root meaning is often translated as peace. And that makes sense as a greeting either at the beginning or when you're going away. It can coordinate with God be with you. I mean, you're wishing a person peace. Okay? But in these Semitic languages, peace, the concept of peace is far more than, like, we tend to think of peace as an absence of conflict. That's what it is. If I'm not fighting with you, then we have peace. But there's a far bigger, that's only a very small part of the concept of peace in Semitic languages. Somebody said wholeness or something like that, right? That's far better kind of term, because what does peace imply? It implies wholeness, soundness, health, well-being, prosperity, living life to its fullest as it was meant to live. Okay? So it's not just absence of conflict, it's all the things that life, the richness and abundance and health and prosperity that life is to me. Okay, so that is what is meant by these words. Now, that should give you an indication of something what the word Islam means. It's related to that root. Salam is the word peace. So Islam has something to do with peace. And indeed, it's based on a root that means two things. The root salama, that's a verb, means first of all to submit or to surrender oneself, and secondly to make peace or to have peace, to enjoy peace. So if you want a really, knowing that, if you can remember SLM, Islam's got that now, what does that mean? The way you can remember it best is Islam refers to the religion of submitting oneself in order to have peace. Now, submitting oneself to what or who? Well, not to another person, to a very specific person, to God. Okay, to God. Okay? So if you want a thumbnail, like Islam in a nutshell, it's the religion of submitting oneself to God, submitting one's ego, one's sense of self to God in order to enjoy peace. Now, peace in this wholeness sense, not just absence of conflict, but peace in terms of wholeness and prosperity, not only in the afterlife, but also in this world. So a lot of Muslims talk about enjoying peace and prosperity and well-being in this world and the next. Okay, and it's through submission of one's will to God. Islam is the verbal noun of this verb. In other words, it's the noun describing that action. It's the noun saying the action of submitting oneself to God to have peace. Okay? And a person, so that's Islam. A person who practices this religion, this submission, is a Muslim. And that's the act of participle form. It's the describing the doer of that action. Okay? So you can see again, see all the SLM, SLM, it's all in there. And if you know, you might sort of see how it also appears in terms of the Arabic script as well. And then we talked about the submission is of oneself is to God. And somebody said Allah, and Allah is the Arabic term for God. You can see it there. It actually means something a little more than just sort of God. It is actually the term for divinity with the definite article the in front of it. So it's not just God, but it's the God. Like, you know, the real God, the one and only God, no other kind of God, right? But basically, Allah and God, the two words are transposable. Christians, Arabic Christians, in their liturgies and so on, when they talk about God or pray to God, Allah is the word that is used as well. So it's not like Allah is the special Muslim God off in some corner, and you know, God, G-O-D, is some other God. Just different. It's like different terms in different languages. Like you say Gott in German or Dieu in French, and God in English. You say Allah in Arabic. Right. So that's the first thing. Everybody got that? Submission of one's will to God in order to have peace. And this is reflected in the greetings that Muslims have incorporated into life. Now, most Muslims, as we learned yesterday in our session, are not Arabic. Only about 1 in 5 Muslims in the world are in Arabic-speaking parts of the world. Most Muslims, therefore, do not speak Arabic at home or with their children. However, since Islam originated in the Arabic Arabian Peninsula, Arabic has kind of become part of the common language and expressions of Muslims worldwide. So even though you'd be an Urdu speaker in India, or an English speaker in Canada or the US, or an Indonesian speaker in Indonesia, there'd be certain Arabic expressions that would be part of your language. And the greeting is probably the most important one. And it's a good one. It'd be a good one for us to learn. This is what a Muslim says to another Muslim when they greet them. They say, Salam alaikum. It means peace be to you. And it's always in plural. It's peace be to you all. Even if it's just one person. Because it's always, well, there's several reasons for that. It's always in the context of community. Muslims have a very strong sense of not being, you know, singular individuals, but always being part of what they call the ummah. The complete global Muslim community. So you're wishing peace in the plural sense there. Sometimes also explained, you have two angels on your shoulders too. You have one angel recording your good deeds, one angel recording the bad deeds. And so when you're saying Salam Alaikum, you're saying peace to you, and those angels are sitting on your shoulders too, who are watching what you're doing and everything. So, and the response is Wa Alaikum Salam, and to you, peace. So you want to try that? It's very simple. So I would come and say to you, Salam Alaikum, and you would say,
Alaykum Salam.
Very good. Excellent. Maybe we'll use that for the next sessions. We'll just start that. But again, you see the emphasis on the peace. That's a very important part of this. Now, so that's Islam sort of in a nutshell. Let's go on to another aspect of Islam. I have another question for you, sort of a test. Who was the first Muslim?
Abraham.
Ishmael.
Muhammad.
You're all wrong. Pardon?
Adam.
Bingo. You win the prize.
Yes. Yes. Adam, I'm talking from within a Muslim, the Muslim belief system, is that Adam is considered to have been the first Muslim. And this is because Muslims believe that Islam is sort of a small I, like generic Islam, now not as a formal religious system, but just think of submitting one's will to God's will and therefore having life in its fullness as it should be, that's the original primordial religious orientation of everybody, right from the beginning. So that the first submitter to God, the first Muslim with a small m, was Adam. Okay, right from the beginning, people naturally are born with the inclination to submit their wills to God's will and therefore to enjoy life in its fullness. Okay, so you begin right back with Adam. Now, of course, there are other forces at work tempting you away from that path that generally tempt you in the sense of forgetting. That's one of the things the devil and his cohorts do, is to make you forget that you are a creature of the Creator, and that you think, you get all puffed up and think that you're independent and everything. So forgetfulness is a really big problem that tempts you away from this primordial orientation. And ungratefulness, what they're seen as, and they're sort of tied together, because if you forget you're a creature, you also aren't grateful for all the blessings that are showered upon you by the Creator. So these two things do tempt people away from their primordial orientation of submission to God, and that leads to problems. So, but God does not leave humanity bereft, Muslims believe, but sends messengers at periodic intervals to different peoples to bring them back to their primordial orientation. And Adam was they called prophets or messengers, and Adam was the first prophet into Islamic belief. First one who called, already right there at the beginning, it was necessary to call people back to their primordial orientation. Now, some of you said Abraham, and Abraham is recognized as, of course, a very important figure in Islam. I put the Arabic form of the names in brackets there. Ibrahim is, again, one of the prophets, one of the messengers sent by God to bring people back to that primary orientation, the primordial religious orientation of submission to God. Right? Moses, also. Same thing, Musa. Also a prophet sent to bring people back to their primordial orientation, to bring people back to submission. Jesus, also. Jesus is considered one of the great prophets in Islam, all right? Also sent by God, a messenger from God, to remind people, because they've forgotten, and to exhort them to be grateful, and to bring them back to that primordial orientation. And finally, and there are many others I haven't, like a lot of them you would recognize. I mean, Ishmael and Isaac are in there, and Noah's in there, and John the Baptist is in there, and lots of figures that we know from our own background in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament. And then there are a few other that are more distinctly from the Arabic Peninsula that would be new to us. But they're all considered prophets. And finally, you have what Muslims consider to be the final prophet, Muhammad, who in the 600s of the Common Era started preaching a message of submission to God and bringing people back to that primordial orientation. So in the Muslim view of things, Muhammad's doing nothing different than Jesus did, than Moses did, than Abraham did, than Adam did. Basically, the idea here is that all of these prophets basically are preaching the same message, a message of returning to the straight path, to the path of its primordial orientation, submitting one's will to God's will in order to enjoy life the way God meant it to be. Now, Muhammad is called the final prophet, though, because Muslims, at least the majority of Muslims, there are some sectarian kind of offshoots of Islam that don't necessarily follow this. But for the majority of Muslims, Muhammad is the final prophet. With him, they believe the the repeated cycles of revelation and of messengers and prophets came to an end. And that with the revelation that was vouchsafed to Muhammad, God completed and perfected his message, or God's message to humanity. So in that sense, Muslims talk about Islam not only being the primordial religion, in other words, a religion that's sort of natural to every human person who's born, not only in history with the first person Adam and Eve, but also every child that's born is born naturally as a submitter to God. But also Islam is the final religion because with Muhammad, the most complete, perfect form of this submission was revealed. So we can talk about, from a Muslim angle at least, understanding Islam as the primordial and the final, as well as the minor religion. This makes sense? It's a sort of... Okay, what we're trying to do here is get into the Muslim mindset, all right? This is how Muslims would understand their religion. And it's very interesting, of course, should be interesting to us, because contrary to other religious orientations who tend to kind of wall off certain aspects, this is kind of one that includes all the previous ones in it. I mean, you know, there are all these figures that we recognize that are in there. Yep.
I asked them, is Muhammad seen as the greatest of the prophets, since he's the final prophet?
Well, I guess it would be probably most correct to say that the revelation given through Muhammad, which is then in the Quran, is seen as the greatest revelation because it completes everything and kind of signs it all off and seals it off. And because Muhammad is the vehicle of that revelation, then Muhammad is also honored as probably the greatest prophet. But not in terms of his own intrinsic qualities as much as because he was the vehicle chosen for this final revelation. So he's often called the seal of the prophets, right? And you know, a seal, when you put a seal on something, it both confirms everything that went before it, and it also says, hey, you know, this is the, you know, the final authorized version. And so, but Muhammad's, I'm doing a session, the last session on Saturday morning will be on Muhammad and Jesus, and Muhammad's highly honored, very highly honored status in Islam, but different from the status of Jesus in Christianity.
Okay, well, let's get to, so we've kind of got Islam in a nutshell, this idea of submission of one's will to enjoy peace. We've got this idea of Islam, Muslims understanding the religion as both the primordial and the final religion, so it kind of includes all these former revelations. Let's now look at probably the kind of central belief statement of Islam. Islam doesn't have, well, there were creeds that were created in Islam, but none of them ever took off, really, like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed did in Christianity. So they're not recited or anything as a statement of faith, but there is a short statement. It's called the Shahada, and the Shahada means witness, so it's not seen as a creed. It's seen as it's like something that you say to prove to yourself that you believe something. It's seen as a witness. It's a message to others. Okay, and it's very short. And being able to say these words with conviction and to follow up then on living according to them is what makes one a Muslim. So let's look at this. The Shahada. Shahada is two very short phrases. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but God. That's the first one. And a second phrase follows it. Wa Muhammad Rasulullah. And Muhammad is the messenger of God. That's it. That's the basic kernel of Muslim. I mean, in terms of any kind of written statement of faith. What Islam is about in its beliefs. Now, let's just talk about that a little bit more. It's always said in Arabic. Okay, so this is one of those little bits of Arabic that every Muslim will learn. If one converts to Islam, the ceremony kind of showing that one is converted is when one professes this formula in front of witnesses. that's it, then one is considered Muslim. It's in constant use. It's part of the call to prayer five times daily. I'm going to be talking about Muslim practices tomorrow, so we'll talk about that. When a child is born, it's the first thing whispered into the child's ear is the Shahada. People will chant it. You might come across a work gang, repairing the road in a Muslim country, and La ilaha illallah, and they'll shove something. Wa Muhammadan Rasulallah. They'll use it as sort of a work chant. Sufis, the mystics of Islam, will use it in devotional practices as a mantra. So it's in very constant use. And one of the religious scholars of study Islam compares this to the symbol of the cross in Christianity. Okay, that what the cross means to Christians is a visual symbol. The Shahada means to Muslims as a verbal or a heard symbol. Okay, so it sort of defines what Islam is about. Now again, remember, it's not called a creed, it's called a witness. So it's a proclamation of one's conviction. It's an imperative to call others to this faith as well. It's two parts. There is no God but God. Now that's can be unfolded in many different ways. On a very basic level, particularly in its historical origins, it's a rejection of idolatry. Okay, there is no other God. There are no other deities except God. Okay, other deities don't really exist. They're imaginary. There is no God but God. But it can also imply a rejection of human tyranny and oppression and domination. In other words, there can be no human agency that can claim to have godlike powers over you. Okay, there is no God but God, no matter whether King so-and-so thinks otherwise. Okay? So it's no earthly power can claim a person's allegiance. It can also mean a rejection of false values of the heart. Anything that occupies a position of preeminence in your heart that isn't God is rejected by this formula. So if the acquisition of wealth or the acquisition of prestige, comfort, and so on become primary in your life, then you've transgressed this. There is no God but God, because it implies that God is at the top of the hierarchy of all your desires and needs. Right? And then the Sufis, the mystics again, have a kind of very interesting interpretation of there is no God but God. They see it as the stages that one comes to true faith. There is no God. Stop. It needs to come to that kind of bottom out, the dark night of the soul, when it doesn't seem like there's any God at all, that there's nothing. When it comes to that, and then suddenly illumination is but God. And so the mystics see in this phrase a whole path of mystical illumination. Okay, but then we have the second. Now, probably for many people of faith in Christianity, for instance, or in Judaism, this is not a problematic statement at all. This is something that we could confess with Muslims, because again, as Christians, we're also monotheists, right? We believe in one God. Now, Muslims have a little problem with this Trinity stuff we're into. They really wonder about that. They're very suspicious of that, because this is so central to them. But it's with the second one that there might be some differences, okay? Muhammad is the messenger of God. This points to Muhammad's function, not his status. In other words, he's the one through whom God gave a message to humanity. It points to the fact that God is not only the only God, but God has something to say, so God communicates, right? Communicates what? Well, God communicates again this primordial orientation. How does one get back to the straight path? So it's not so much a communication of what is true, but of what is right. Okay? In other words, it's not so much a function on having the right beliefs or believing the true things, but in acting in accordance with God's original intention. In other words, walking the straight path. Questions at this point, yeah.
Yeah, the Muhammad is the messenger of God. Is you can play with that as you did, as you said the Sufi did with the top.
Okay.
And I wonder if that happens. I mean, you can read it, Muhammad is the messenger of God. Mm-hmm. Or you can read it as Muhammad is the messenger of God, not to be confused with. I mean, and I don't know if that happens or if there's any.
That's interesting. No, I don't know if that happened. Now, the whole status of Muhammad is an interesting topic, right? It's suffice to say here that Muhammad is to Islam not like Jesus is to Christianity, okay?
And I kind of hear that in that. I mean, Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Right.
Don't confuse that with God.
No, definitely not. Yes.
Almost like
because there is no God but God, yeah, so, right. You know, that comes first.
Yeah.
What was the nature of the Muslim faith then, before Muhammad?
Well, there wasn't, in terms of the primordial faith of a submission to one God's Muslim, small m, just submission to God, that would have been part of Judaism, Christianity, and so on before. Pre-Islamic Arabia was a mishmash of lots of different things, largely kind of animistic, tribal gods and beliefs, fatalistic beliefs. Some people didn't believe in any transcendent thing. When you're dead, so you better make a big splash so people talk about you. That's how you'll survive, by in the stories that are told about you. There was some knowledge of Judaism and Christianity. There were Jewish tribes that lived in the Arabian Peninsula. There were Christian traders who came through. There were some Zoroastrians around, but largely it was sort of a animistic, polytheistic kind of. Back there.
I want to get you to unpack a comment that you made, which is that Islam is primarily about going the right way or doing the right thing, rather than about right belief.
Right.
That, I think, makes it very different from a lot of the ways people interpret Christianity, which is about believing certain propositions.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And so discussion among Muslims is not that much about right belief.
No, because it's fairly simple, right? You know, I mean, here it is. There's no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. Now, what do you do? How do you live your life? And is the more important question. Probably a better analogy would be to make an analogy between Islam and Orthodox Judaism. Because also in Orthodox Judaism, matters of belief, that's not so important. But following the Torah, the way that God has outlined for you to go, the path, how do you live according to God's will? So what do you do? What is right to do? Is a more important question than what is the right thing or the true thing to believe. So Muhammad is much more like Moses, right? Okay, Moses is a leader who was a messenger from God, revealed the Torah, and the Torah includes a lot of directions on how to live according to God's will. And so also in Islam, there's a parallel concept to the Torah in Judaism. It's called the Sharia, and it's the holy law or the divine law. Okay, now it's a organically growing compendium of guidance for life, drawing on a lot of different sources, including the Quran and other things. But that's the basic concern of a lot of Muslims, is not so much am I believing the right thing, but now I'm going to go into this business dealing. How do I do it the right way according to God's intention? That kind of, how do I educate my kids according to God's intention? Whatever. Yeah.
It seems as if the religious principles and the political philosophies are inextricably tied. high. And I have to believe that's more than just the absence of a prohibition of separation of church and state. We see this not only between Islamic entities and, if you will, the outside world, but we see this in the infighting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And I'm wondering, how did that dynamic evolve?
Well, think the Moses is, again, the good example that is understandable to us. Moses was a prophet, you know, and got a revelation from God and everything, but he's also a legislator. He's also a person who led the armies of Israel in battle and led them, you know, on the Exodus. And, well, Muhammad fits that role. We're not used to religious leaders in that role because Jesus didn't fit the mold the same way at all. But Muhammad did. So Muhammad not only preached repentance and a message of returning to God, but also was a legislator. I mean, for the first Muslim community, he was the supreme authority and laid down the rules, often by revelation again. So you have this body of law being laid down. Now, as far as that body of how to live according to God's will, those rules and regulations weren't parceled out. Just, you know, it only concerns how I pray. It concerns every aspect of life. So no sphere of life is immune to the call to follow God's way. Whether it's how you earn your living, whether it's how you conduct your family affairs, whether it's how you pray, or whether it's how you govern your country. So to Muslims, from a Muslim viewpoint, this idea of separation of church and state seems ludicrous. I mean, God is ruler over that, over state as well as church, if you want to kind of term it that way. So that's why there is that strong concern. Now, it's very interesting you said there's infighting, because people, we're still human beings trying to understand what God's will is, and of course we disagree about what God's will is. There are lots of Muslims producing all kinds of writing to say that, I mean, democracy is Islamically grounded. You know, and they find concepts of consultation and so on that undergird their understanding that you should have elections and elect leaders and so on. And then there are others who say, no, democracy is a Western foreign concept. It's nothing to do with Islam. And they'll try to find some other way of other models of governance. You know. But the basic premise, they're united on the basic premise, which is that politics is not separate from religion because God is Lord of all those aspects of life, and therefore you have to seek God's will. How do you submit to God's intention in your political life as well as in your religious and social and family life?
It's strange for us to think that there can be a religion where belief is not particularly important, since Christians seem to spend most of their time talking about how we can grow in the knowledge of God.
Yeah.
It reminded us that the image which we have in our minds is that of the cross. And this is where we start with the crucified Christ, and then we build on that, and we think that God is the redemptive power of love, which is revealed in the cross, or God is a spirit revealed in the cross, or God is that creative power which wills our wholeness and healing. In spite of what you said, I find it hard to believe that Muslims don't have the spirit of inquiry in their minds and want to know what or who God
is.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean,
what
I use the idea of Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, is probably far more of this case. Like, what you do is far more important than what you believe. I mean, you've all heard of, you know, people, Jews who believe they're Jews and they're part of Judaism, and they're agnostics or atheists. You know, I mean, that's possible. Islam kind of is in the middle between Christianity's emphasis on right belief and maybe Orthodox Judaism's emphasis on right action. There's been a lot of exploration of the nature of God. It's always somewhat viewed with suspicion by a lot of Muslim people. Like, the masses don't really want to get into that. That's God, and to inquire into the nature of God too deeply gets you into deep water. But there have been, you know, famous philosophers who have affected Western philosophy as well from the Middle Ages, who have explored the nature, what's God like, what's the nature of God, how is God one, is the God's word part of God's eternal nature, or is it something created? Does God have attributes? Are the attributes part of God, or are they, temporal things? Is this sort of getting at what you're asking?
Well, can I ask another question?
Sure.
Since you give me an opportunity. We think in terms of our faith as being an experience, and following along with what I was saying, our experience is the experience of redemption, as well as the joy of believing and the spiritual gifts of hope and love and faith. Well, what you've shared with us, the experience in Islam is the experience of peace, which seems to us to be a very passive kind of experience. Where is that, what corresponds to us, the experience of redemption, of being taken into something which we were previously not, which we can focus on as the center of our faith?
It would be the practice of prayer, because it happens on a regular, recurring, cyclical kind of thing during the day. That is, I mean, go to a mosque sometime and observe Muslims at prayer. And it's kind of very striking, the kind of spiritual spark or electricity that goes on during that time. But it's part of the doing of the thing. It's not just sort of a contemplative realization of that without doing anything.
Well, I guess my question that follows on that is the idea, for example, of redemption a big deal?
No. I mean, remember what I said is that all human beings are born with this primordial orientation. There's no need for an atoning experience of some sort. Nobody needs to die for somebody else. I mean, this is another point where Muslims have a bone to pick with Christians. They don't see any necessity for the redeeming death of Jesus, for instance. Any person, you're born with that inclination. Since you forget or you're ungrateful, you need to be called back. So the experience of redemption, if anything, is to hear the call and go, oh, yeah. You know, God, please forgive me. Show me your straight path. And God says, I forgive you. Here's the straight path. Walk on it. It's very interesting. We could look at the story of Adam and Eve in the Quran. It's very interesting, you know. Adam and Eve, you know, they do the wrong thing in the Quranic account. They eat of the fruit that they're not supposed to. And they're the devil's in there in the Quranic account. Very much not, he's not there in the Genesis accounts that we're familiar with, but he's there, he tempts them, because the devil does that sort of thing. He tempts them to follow a path. They both, God says, look, you did this, you're going to have to go out of paradise, you're going to have to live on the earth and everything, and the devil's going to tempt you, and they say, oh, we're sorry, we repent, please show us the true path. And God says, yeah, you're forgiven. I'll just follow the true path. There's no sense of an original sin or kind of a defect that has to be overcome by some sort of atoning or redeeming death. Everybody's born with that inclination, can be called back to it. It's in the capability of anybody, right?
I recall there are two principal areas. There's Sunni Muslims, Shia
Muslims, yeah.
Is there a difference in a fundamental difference in theology dating back to Muhammad that separates the two?
No, it's a fundamental difference in who leads the Muslim community after Muhammad's death. So it's more kind of like a political or community issue. But theologically, by and large, there's a basic foundational similarity in the beliefs. That would take a little while to unpack that.
Just a question of family and who takes whose place.
Who? Yeah, Muhammad dies, and he's not only the prophet, but he's also the leader of that community. Who takes over the leadership? It's a kind of burning question. Let me put one more thing up for you, and then just because I said we were going to look at the basic beliefs, and I have a little chart that shows you that what are the seven basic beliefs in Islam, and I've talked a lot about this one because it's really the central one, the belief in God or Allah, the one God, a very strict monotheism. Okay? In Islam, this belief is called Tawheed, and it comes from the word Wahid, which means one. It's the numeral one, so it's, you know, related to the oneness of God. That's kind of the basic fulcrum of Islamic belief. God is the only God. God is the creator. God is completely unique. You can't compare anything to God. If you start comparing things to God, you're committing idolatry. God is absolute one and different and other and unique and so on. And God is completely in control. And so connected to this belief in Tawheed is, for most Muslims, is a belief in predestination, or called divine destiny. That in the final analysis, everything that happens can happen only by the permission and the will of God.
Inshallah.
Well, that's another expression that you find in Muslims. Muslims will often say inshallah, like I'll meet you tomorrow, yeah, inshallah, which means if God wills, or as God wills. Or, you know, they hear about something happen, they say, mashallah, what God wills. Okay? So this is really central, this thing here. But then we have the two other Risala means messengership, message. And you have the fact that God isn't away in heaven isolated, but that God communicates actively with the human world. So Muslims believe in angels. In other words, there's a transcendent reality in which our reality is immersed. And there are beings that we don't see with our material senses, but they're real nonetheless. God uses angels as agents to do God's bidding, right? And they exist. But God also uses human messengers. So there's belief in God's messengers. These would include Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses and King David and Jesus and Muhammad. Some of those messengers also brought books. So there's a belief in God's books, God's revealed books. Now, preeminently it's the Quran, but Muslims also talk about Abraham having revealed certain scrolls, Moses having revealed the Torah, and Jesus having revealed the gospel. Okay, and that these were important scriptures that God revealed through these messengers. Now, it's very interesting, because in practice, Muslims don't refer to those other scriptures. They refer to the Quran alone, because the Quran, for two reasons, because the Quran is believed by them to be the most complete, perfect revelation of God, and secondly, because they know that the Quran and some of these other scriptures do have contradictions and disagree, they believe that the other scriptures were corrupted over time. That they were pure scriptures at the time of their revelation, but that as they were transmitted through history, human accretions grew into them and distortions. Things were dropped out, things were added in. So that today's version of the Torah or of the gospel aren't authentic anymore. And then on this side, we have akhir, which means the hereafter. Muslims believe this is not the only life you live. There's very definitely a hereafter. And the gate between this life and the next life is the Day of Judgment. Okay, where every soul will be judged on the basis of its life. That's why there's the recording angels type of thing. There's various pictures of this. Often you're pictured as being given the book of your life. You know, and you page through it, and basically nobody's judging you. Your own life is the judgment on you. You know, like you get the book and you go, ugh. And if you get it, and that is sometimes, if you get it in your left hand, that's not very good. If you get it in your right hand, you know, then it's good. And then the hereafter is, there are two possibilities. There's the garden or paradise, and then there's the fire or hell. Seen as the two possibilities. Now, very important, I want to emphasize about God. Often non-Muslims or other outsiders think of the God or Allah as being a fairly strict, demanding God. But the most common phrase that you find repeated in the Quran again and again is Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, most compassionate, most merciful. And that is the primary kind of an attribute of God. Now, God is also a person who is in charge of the Day of Judgment and calls people to account. But most Muslims would argue that in the end, God's mercy outweighs God's judgment. So there's this kind of graciousness of that. I want to do this very quickly because we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I want to make sure you had this before you ask any more questions. I'm sure there are others. Yeah.
Are you going to be doing the Quran?
Yeah.
Later
I'm doing the Quran on Friday. We're going to read the story of Cain and Abel, both in the biblical version and the Quranic version, and then
I'll
you'll.
Say my question.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
When determines whether they go into the fire or paradise?
Again, it's it's sort of like your life, what you've done with it. But it's not. I mean, that sounds too much like, you know, well, did you do enough good deeds to outweigh the bad deeds? It's also your orientation. I mean, because, you know, there's always the possibility of turning back to God and going on the straight path. So, you know, I mean, it's theoretically possible for you to be the most horrible person in the world, but you at some point said, forgive me, God, show me the path, and God said yes, and you go to paradise. But it's you yourself. It's there's some belief that somebody, there's a very strong aversion to anybody sort of being able to intercede for you, although some Muslim groups say, well, you can call on Muhammad on the last day, maybe Jesus sometimes, to intercede for you on the last day, just to get that extra oomph, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's very missionary emphasis
yes. Very strong. The three missionary religions in the world are Christianity, of course, Islam, and Buddhism. These all have mandates to go out and give witness to this faith and to encourage others to enter the fold. So it's a very strong missionary position. There's a lady here, and then I'll go back to you.
I was wondering, is this appropriate to ask about the jihad?
Yes, certainly you can ask. That's sort of the one of the things we'll do with practice tomorrow. Jihad is often translated holy war, right?
Yeah.
The word means this: strenuous exertion. Strenuous exertion. And every Muslim is called to jihad. In other words, to strenuously exert themselves in living their faith. Okay?
So war is acceptable.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of it. There's a saying of Muhammad that talks about the lesser jihad and the greater jihad. In other words, the less important one and the more important one. He said the most important, the greater jihad, is the jihad that goes on in every believer's heart to try, struggle to remain, to be faithful and to follow the straight path and to discern God's will. The lesser jihad is the effort of the community of Muslims to defend itself or to defend its integrity against outside attack. Okay, now that can take many different forms. That can take the form of education, it can take the form of social justice, it can take the form of armed struggle if necessary. So there's sort of a just war theory at work in Islam as well. It's a misused concept a lot. It's misused in the Western press to describe things. It's also misused, a lot of Muslims would argue, by these groups that claim they are engaged in a jihad when they engage in, you know, acts of terrorism or violence.
Yeah. In the United States, many members of the African American community become followers of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the growth of Islam, and I'm wondering if there's anything in particular, whether demographic, socioeconomic, ethnic, racial, or whatever, that would cause this, perhaps, if you will, disproportionate.
Yes. Because Islam has historically been far more egalitarian than Christianity. I mean, some sociologists said the most segregated hour in North America is on Sunday morning, right? Okay. And this is the kind of experience I had when I was in North Carolina and Durham in Paul's congregation. He was largely African American congregation. It was wonderful because there was a spectrum of people there. And then I went back to good old white Regina, where I live, which actually has a large Native population. But boy, you go to church on Sunday morning, and it's all these white folks. Well, I go to the mosque, and it's a kaleidoscope. There are people from Sudan, from India, there are Bosnians who are blonde, there are, you know, it's just, and they're all on an equal footing. I mean, there is no sense of kind of superiority that I could at least pick up. This has been immensely attractive to, you know, African Americans. And then there's the fact that many of the slaves who were brought over originally came from parts of Africa that were Muslim and likely that were practicing Muslims when they came, at least a good proportion of them were. So there's also that argument that that's more original. But largely, it's like the experience of Malcolm X. You know, he had this very strong separatist, hate whites and all that stuff. And then he went on pilgrimage to Mecca. And he was sleeping in the same rooms and doing all this pilgrimage stuff with all these people, you know, of all different colors and all different cultures and everything, all doing things together. And he said he realized that what he preached before, that didn't make sense anymore. Here was a truly egalitarian religion that did not, at least in its more ideal sense, not practice segregation or slavery. It's not completely true. But it's more true of Islam than it is of Christianity historically and even in the contemporary world. So there's a very strong draw there. Yeah.
Are women involved in the disciplines and the prayer life and all that?
Yeah, gender in Islam, that's always a really good one. there's a strong emphasis on what Muslims call gender equity, but also separate roles for men and women. Okay, this comes usually from the family emphasis in Islam. Well, that has such a bad ring to it, I hate to say it, because, as far as responsibilities for God, before God, I mean, you know, you're responsible, every individual is responsible for their religious duties, for prayer, all that stuff. Just because let's say you're a woman, you can't say, well, my husband does my religious stuff for me, that doesn't count, okay? However, and this is not necessarily always strictly Islamic, but it's often cultural in terms of the cultural areas in which Islam grew and where it's present, which are very traditional societies. So public space belongs to men, domestic space belongs to women. Okay? You'll see that there's a very strict separation between domestic and public space. For instance, houses in the Middle East, they'll have the private quarters, and then there'll be one room or a courtyard, which is more sort of pub. That's where you come to visit, but you never go into the other parts of the house. And men are the ones that generally are out working. And this is ideally, or the structure this way, it doesn't work this way all the time, are more doing the transactions in the public sphere. Women are doing the transactions and in control of the domestic sphere. There's a very strong stress on gender separation in the public sphere. You associate intimately only with members of your own family. Okay, so uncontrolled mixing of men and women is frowned upon, at least traditionally, in Muslim society. So, for instance, if you go to a mosque, you may find no women there at all. If you find women there, they may be praying in a separate room, or they'll be praying separate in a separate group from the men. Okay, they don't mix together. To throw another wrench into it for you, is a lot of people don't realize there is a very strong Islamic feminist movement. And these are women who are now, but they do it, you know, they're doing it within the parameters of the system they've set up. They meet in their women groups. They study Quran, they study the Sharia, the law, and they're coming back now with their interpretations and saying, you know, because there's a strong misogynist tendency in Islam, as there is in Christianity and Judaism as well, right? It's very easy for men to justify their position when you're a Christian or Jewish. So also when you're Islamic, and you can do it, right? Well, good passages in 1 Timothy and so on that we can rely on for these things. Well, so also in Islam. Now, what these Muslim women are doing is they're coming back, and the men say, well, you can't do that, you're a woman. They're saying, well, we've studied the sources, and this is how we understand it. Now you tell us where we're wrong. They're kind of like, you know, and they're getting kind of flustered because the women are taking control of the religious knowledge now as well. So it's kind of interesting. Well, one other thing I should say about women, just to wrap this up, is that Muslim women have always, from the beginning of Islam, been seen as independent persons who had control of their own finances. In other words, a Muslim woman, even if she's married, her husband had no right to her wealth, to her money. She was always totally in control of that. She, you know, kept her own name, all that sort of stuff, right from the beginning. And it's good to know that, because it was only in the last 100 years that women in North America had the right to have their own bank accounts when they were married. And it's not that long, well, it's a little bit long ago now, but it's within the last century that when you got married, you couldn't open your own bank account without your husband's permission. Well, you know, Muslims would say, well, we were, I was able to do that right from the beginning.
Except you can't go to the bank to get to it, right?
Well, you use the internet. Well, and the other thing is, how many female presidents of the U.S. have there been? Yet there's been a female president of Pakistan, which is the second largest Muslim country in the world. I don't know, that says something. I mean, you know, it's not so simple, right? That's all I'm saying. I think we're probably well past our time here. So I'd be happy to talk more with people individually or so on. Tomorrow it's at 6:20. No, 3:45 in the afternoon. Tomorrow at 3:45 in the afternoon, I'm talking, it's in the fireside room, and it's on practice.